In the deep dark, the Aslan are moving, but there is a darker power. There is something behind the claw.
Welcome to episode 8 of the Behind the Claw podcast. This is a show for fans of the classic Traveller RPG. Once again, my email bag was filled with an email from Andy. He's written to me again, and this time he's included a short piece of Traveller fiction, which I'll be reading to you at the end of the podcast. Shall we get started? I have no idea. So, computer, what can you tell me about this place? This is my galaxy, where I tell you about a particular planetary system in the Tasesso subsector. You can find a map for this subsector on the website at behindtheclaw.blogspot.co.uk. Today we're talking about the planet Brapla. Brapla and the nearby Quindol Jabi are listed as amber zones due to the high levels of piratical predation on traders in these areas. Which is all rather strange when you consider that the small little base on Brapla has never been bothered by pirate raids. The base constitutes the only population on the planet of Brapla. Its tainted atmosphere has prevented any kind of migration to the planet. The base staff normally only numbers somewhere between 50 and 70 persons. The base itself was established by the Imperial Scouting Service decades ago, but has long since been given up to a private enterprise. The owners of the base are the Nutterdyne Corporation, that maintain this base on a purely commercial research basis. They are planning on mapping all resources available on the planet, and once that process is complete, they'll sell that information to a larger company capable of exploiting the information. The base is administered by Ruduel Kilui, who manages the day-to-day operations. He oversees the mapping, the drilling, and the various testing processes. They currently have 4/5 of the land mapped, and most of the underwater due to an extensive drone use. There are always drilling parties out at various locations around the planet, carrying out the mineral surveying, and on occasion, fauna study expeditions. The majority of the information collected so far remains a closely guarded secret, although some tidbits have been released as teasers for those who may have an interest in exploiting the planet's resources. The planet does have a very active ecosystem, but none of it is considered friendly or intelligent. Nutterdyne have said that they estimate the mapping of this planet's resources will be complete within the next 20 years or so. Landing on Brapla is prohibited by the Nutterdyne Corporation.
No way. The way I heard it is that he was shipping arms, guns, you know, taking them straight in under the navvy's nose.
It's story seed time, and here I just give you a hint at perhaps the start of a scenario. Today we're having a look at the planet Avekeia. It has a small starport. The key navigational transponders for ships wishing to land at the starport are formed by a trio of devices. One is on the roof of the control tower at the starport, the other on a navigational satellite in geostationary orbit, and the third on a mountaintop 40 miles from the starport. The PCs will be contacted by the starport authorities to make and run checks on all three transponders. On two recent occasions, ships have crashed when coming in under guidance computer control because the beacons have become unreliable. The PCs will be provided with the appropriate testing equipment by the authorities, and charged with visiting all three transponders and running the tests. The transponder in space will need to be captured and tested and then redeployed. The mountaintop transponder will need to be climbed to rather than flown up to. The atmosphere on Akea is too active and too rough for safe flight next to the mountaintop. And besides, there's nowhere to land up there. The rooftop unit can be easily visited and checked. The fault will not be found using the testing equipment, which is only designed to check the hardwired elements. The fault is actually with the software installed on the transponders. Any PCs with programming skills may spot the dodgy-looking code. The software has actually been hacked by political separatists on Achaia. They will not be happy with the PCs for interfering in their political realm and will send assassins to take care of them. The authorities, at least at the starport, have no idea that the separatists are responsible for this sabotage action. But if pressed, they might suggest that it could be a completely innocent rival political faction.
No, sir, you may not dock here.
What the hell? I just made 3 jumps to get here.
Without permit 7C, you may not dock. Now move out to the holding line at 6,000 kilometres.
This is the Rules Talk section, where I chat to you about something to do with the rules of Traveller. Today, let's have a little talk about tainted atmospheres. The standard world generation from Book 3 allows you to create worlds that have atmospheres that are tainted. Yet there's not a lot of information about what that actually means. Here are the few raw facts that I've managed to snaffle from the core books. Wearing a vac suit protects you from a tainted atmosphere. At the very least, walking around in a tainted atmosphere requires that you wear a filter mask. The animals that are found on a planet with a tainted atmosphere are less edible. This gives you a -3 on a normal 5+ roll to see whether an animal is edible. A filter mask will only cost you 10 credits. The Scout book suggests that tainted will increase the planetary temperature by 5 to 15%. Now, none of this actually tells us what tainted actually means. There may be some examples within the adventure books, but to be honest, searching all of those is a wee bit daunting. So I thought I'd just share some of my own thoughts about what could be meant by a tainted atmosphere. As the rule suggests that you can breathe the atmosphere with a simple filter mask, that suggests the air can't be too unpleasant. So what kind of taints can there be? I think there are 3 general forms: chemical, biological, and particulate. But let's break those down a bit. Chemical taints covers a vast array of possibilities. Everything from simple ammonia in the air giving it a bad smell, right through to aerosolized toxins, which may have come from natural phenomena like volcanoes spewing forth nasties, or the results of human action. It could be, for instance, the detritus of a past war, or indeed an ongoing war, or some industrial process. Perhaps the taint is being reduced as the Weyland-Yutani atmosphere processors continue working. As for biological contaminants, these could likewise come in a variety of forms. Microbes that cause lung infections, spores, extreme pollination, maybe pheromones that cause hallucinations or simple vomiting. Perhaps the excrement of flyers that live in the upper atmosphere rains down, causing bloody ruin to the throat of any that breathe it. As for particulate taints, these could be smog caused by industrial action, or out-of-control fires or ash thrown up by volcanoes. It could be sand blown from the deserts, all of which could also be the home for nasty microbes blowing on the wind. Maybe the planet is rich in a valuable ore, and that needs the ground to be pounded and ground to dust, and it's that dust that's thrown up into the atmosphere causing the problem. In general, I think it would be more interesting if you allow the taint to affect more than just breathing, such as the dust clogging jet intakes, chemical taints that cause slime mould to grow everywhere, perhaps making everything feel disgusting. There is a lot of potential that the taint could be used for, to feed into and build up your scenarios, to make the environment more detailed and rich. Sadly, the rules in this case don't help you with that, and limit themselves to the single word, tainted.
Ah, damn piece of junk! Who bought this anyway? No, don't you dare say it was me.
And this is the review section of the show. Today, I'm taking a look over core book number 8, Robots. And everybody loves a good robot, as proved by Robbie, who appeared on Altair 4, or Huey, Louie and Dewey on the Valley Forge. I suppose the less cultured amongst you might prefer a certain lower class R2 unit or one of the 3POs, but let's not dwell on such low-class things. This review is looking at the PDF that you can purchase via DriveThruRPG. Once again, this is a scan of the original 1986 printing, although it does look as if some cleanup has been done on it. However, as you flick through, you will note some marks and lines that were on the original copy they scanned. There are 59 pages of fairly dense text. Unlike many Traveller original products, though, this one has three pieces of artwork in it. Each is a nicely detailed pencil drawing. The book starts out with some background material explaining how robots fit into the various Traveller cultures. Next up, it describes the various types of robot, from the dumb calculating machine all the way up to those that can't be told apart from humans. And then comes a section talking about robots within non-imperial societies, including all of the main alien races. There's a nice section here that gives you an idea of the mental abilities of robots at the various tech levels. The next section introduces you to robot construction. This is rather like building starships within the Traveller system, allowing you to build a bespoke robot. This is a lot of detail to work through, as all the modules and appendages you can add to a robot are explained. We also get introduced to the robot UPP, which is quite long. Then comes some fun for the referee as robot encounters are dealt with, including some random tables. Robots have their own reaction table as well, just like animals. And this book also introduces a couple of new robot-related skills for PCs to use. The book also covers robots in combat, and using them as NPCs if you should wish, and even as PCs. So what do I think of it? There's some good background material here that helps to flesh out the Traveller background in general. But apart from that, I didn't enjoy what this book offered. I'm aware that the reason for this is that I don't like sentient robots, and that's colouring my opinion. If I'm going to have a robot in my game, I'll just say there's a robot. But using this book requires that robots be detailed to way too much detail for my liking. Now, having said that, if a player does want to actually play the part of a robot, then I would have to break out this book. I'd feel obliged to, so that you can detail all the stats of that robot correctly within this system. So as I've said with many other products, if you have the spare cash and this is something that appeals to you, then go for it. You're not going to lose out by buying this book, but it's certainly not one that you need to have.
Did you hear that? What the hell do you think it is? Is it dangerous?
Today in the Creature Catalogue, I'm going to tell you about the Varhurst. This is an extremely dangerous yet useful and valuable creature. Originally found on the unpopulated garden world of Hazael 2, this creature was responsible for earning the planet an amber zone in the standard Imperial catalogues. It is bipedal, and in outline represents the more common bipedal lizards found throughout Imperial space. However, it dwarfs most lizard forms. It stands 8 feet to its hip and can stretch upright to 12 feet tall when stationary. It measures 24 feet from the tips of its twin tails to its snout. Covered in a chitinous shell with a large body, the animal looks as if it should be slow and ponderous, but the truth is very different. The Varhurst can sprint extremely fast, a speed which it uses to hunt pretty much anything that is smaller than itself, including humans. Its well-muscled legs also allow the creature to make terrific jumps under normal gravity. As one researcher remarked shortly after its discovery, "You can't outrun it. You can't fight those teeth and tentacles. And it can smell you, so there's nowhere to hide. It can smash barricades and tear the door off your air raft. A gun? Don't make me laugh. It's armoured. And I'm not going back down there." Despite the danger the Varhurst presented, Hazael II was eventually settled and the Varhurst, if not domesticated, was at least farmed. Within the animal's torso, glands responsible for creating its armoured shell were discovered to contain complex biological enzymes useful in medical processes. The value of them made it a reasonable proposition to farm this dangerous animal with all the expensive precautions required to keep the rapacious animal under control. The Varhurst is known to be farmed on at least 15 worlds at this time, and the demand for the enzymes it produces is still growing.
So I'm here. Why don't you tell me why you called?
The spacer in the corner booth. Don't stare at him.
I see him. Who is he?
It's the guy on the news vids.
Which news vids? There are thousands of channels.
Crookwatch.
Ah, I see.
Now it's time to take a look at another person of interest. Hail Ulla is well known within certain subsectors of the Spinwood Marches, known for being a ruthless criminal, known for being a pirate. Navy interviews with captured members of Hale's piratical forces have learned quite a bit about him. His homeworld, however, is not known, but it is understood that he was captured by Varg raiders and served as a slave crewman for the Varg privateers from the age of 10 until his mid-20s. He won his freedom from his captors by years of undaunting service leading up to one-on-one fight with a particularly nasty Varg called Ulla. As the winner of this bloody knife fight, Hale took the vessel of the Varg he'd killed and his family name of Ulla. Hale's own family name has long since been forgotten. In his early years of ship ownership, Hale travelled with a crew of Varg freebooters, and got quite a reputation for being the only human leading an entirely Varg crew as he started his raidings across various outposts and stations. He soon gained a reputation for ruthlessness, often killing all of the occupants of the places that he raided, and even spacing the crews of the ships he attacked. After a couple of years of raids, he started on a pattern that was soon picked up on by the Navy. His raids turned almost entirely piratical, being focused on taking small, jump-capable ships. During one standard year, he and his followers were held responsible for no less than 13 ship captures. It was during this period that he started recruiting humans into his team. These new recruits often served under the leadership of the Varg crewman from his original ship. The captured ships were not sold, but rather were rebadged and used for future raids and ship thefts. By constantly using different ships and different approaches, he was able to keep surprising crews across a dozen systems and take their ships away from them. Navy pursuit was often fruitless. Hale was very careful to train his crews in when and where to make an attack. One of the captured pirates told a story of waiting for 2 weeks in radio silence under the cover of an asteroid, waiting for the perfect opportunity to carry out an attack. Eventually, Hale upgraded the combat capability of his fleet by an assault and capture of a mercenary destroyer. From there, he made his fleet significantly stronger with further cutting out raids on further spacecraft. At this time, he is currently known to have 3 destroyers, 1 cruiser, and 1 older model carrier, plus, of course, his fleet of armed traders. Navy attempts to track him down have so far failed. His home base is a station somewhere, but none of the prisoners have been able to identify the location, as the Varg have always been the ones in control of navigation, and none of them have been captured. At present, the Navy has allocated a flotilla under the famed Captain Jamon Tullock to track down Hale and his minions. They are constantly searching the deep dark for his base.
My God, sir, they've launched a missile. It's tracking.
Have they now? Don't fret, Thane. I've got something special to handle that. Lancelot, activate my special defensive feature.
I mentioned in the opening that we'd be having a bit of fiction today. Well, here it is. It's called No More Running, a Traveller Flash Fiction by Andrew Pickard. Running. Again. It had to stop. Jump Space was Melissa's sanctuary, offering an interlude of peace. And yet it also fostered brooding, worry, building tension. She paced about the scout ship's common area, cradling her daughter, their daughter, to her breasts. Would he be waiting at the entrance to normal space, like a Kelrin beast at a Hambert burrow? She watched the wee one in her arms bubble from the mouth and wave fat, fisted hands. Such a primitive little thing, thriving in totally artificial surroundings. The air she breathed was recycled, purified, humidified, heated and circulated by computerized machines. The gravity that helped her bones form normally on the little scout vessel Honeybee emanated from deck plate technology, so advanced that only a tiny fraction of the Empire's citizenry truly comprehended it. The only thing in her confined world not granted by advanced technology was the milk she greedily suckled from her mother. Melissa waited for her to loose hold of the nipple. She shifted her to the other breast. The motion was automatic, the child's intense need for her both comforting and terrifying. Melissa's universe, once so wide and exhilarating, now focused down like a singularity to the baby in her arms. And yet while her daughter fed, her mind roiled with formulae, vectors, transfer times, orbital insertions. In the week since entering jump space, a plan had formed, and success, even their lives, depended on her numbers. She'd checked them with the scout's computer, but it was merely a gesture, a nod to superstition. Navigating the Imperium and beyond was instinctive, her computations without question, her timing dead certain. A decade of scout service and years of piloting for mercantile companies had honed her gift for spatial relations to an almost preternatural level. If anyone could outwit him, she could. 5 minutes until normal space, Melissa. The voice from the intercom was soft and feminine, though a tinge artificial. Thanks, Arnie, she replied to the air. You'd better set up the turret. I sincerely hope violence won't be necessary. Melissa was not so sure she shared that desire. The notion of catching her pursuer at the other end of Honeybee's pulse lasers brought savage satisfaction. And Arnie's special, albeit highly illegal, programming increased the odds of success greatly. She shrugged one arm into a sleeve of her coveralls and tugged it up over her shoulder, and then stepped into the main passageway. She watched Arnie, a gold and silver servant robot, adroitly climb the ladder through the hatch into the ceiling. Melissa hurried towards the bow of the scout and entered the bridge, and then sat in the command chair and took one final moment to gaze at the nursing baby. Worth all this trouble and so much more, she told herself. The grey ooze of jump space roiled outside the view screen. She sat the baby in her lap and sealed up the jumpsuit, and then tucked her offspring's chubby form into a sturdy fabric pouch stitched over this garment's belly. Finally, she pulled the modified G-harness over her shoulders and fastened it. She watched the chrono count down the seconds to normal space. 5, 4, 3. Melissa touched a button on her computer terminal, initiating a special navigational program. 0. The soup of jump space disappeared in less than an instant, and the harsh vacuum of normal space filled her view. The stern of a Soleimani escort, his ship, gleamed off her starboard quarter. She braced against the shock of the maneuver drives as Honeybee bucked and twirled in obedience to its program, and watched as pulses of hard, hot light tore through space and burned into the escort's maneuver drives. The escort, unable to bring its fixed guns to bear on the flitting Honeybee, launched clouds of ablative sand in a desperate attempt to fend off the attack. 2 missiles shot ahead of it on a wide arcing vector, forced to go for the long way around to their target. Flashes of laser fire vaporized them. "Say hello to Daddy," said Melissa to her child.
"Thanks for the trade, Tuchel. It was a pleasure doing business with you. So long, sucker."
So we've reached the end game once more. Please get in touch if you've created or used a fun, tainted atmosphere in your games, or even just come up with a good idea for one. Likewise, if you have an idea for an animal, feel free to send it my way. Do you have a person of interest? Let me know about them. Or if, like Andy, you've got a creative bent towards writing fiction, keep it short and let me know about it. If you have any thoughts, suggestions, questions or stories, send them in to behindtheclaw@outlook.com. Thanks for listening. This podcast is released on an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Its home on the web is at behindtheclaw.blogspot.co.uk. Music by Kevin MacLeod of incompetech.com. I'm your host, Felbrig Napoleon Herriot. Thanks for listening. Prepare for jump.